Good morning. I'd invite you to open your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes in chapter 1. As Samantha, the kids, and I just yesterday got back in town from a gospel meeting in Cookeville, Tennessee. And we were there for 8 days. And the church there 6 months ago, the preacher, his daughter and the daughter's husband and their 2-year-old son died in a tornado. Many of you probably saw that on social media. It was in the news and stuff like that. And then 2 years ago, also, the family that we stayed with, they had an 18 or 19 month old son named Isaac who drowned. And so over the last couple of years, that church has gone through a lot of difficulties and a lot of hardships. And it was encouraging to spend time with them. It was encouraging to see the way that they've handled the tragedies and the suffering in their life. Learned a lot of good things from them. They wanted to say thanks to all of you for sharing me for that period of time. It's good to be back with all of you. This morning, I want us to consider some things in Ecclesiastes. And I want to ask this question. Have you ever gotten depressed or deeply saddened when reading the Bible? I remember when I first became a Christian, how I wanted to make sure the first year and a half or so of being a Christian that I had read the whole Bible. And so I printed out a table of contents of the Bible, and I started crossing off all the books that I had read. And every time I read a new one, I crossed it off, not to get check marks sort of thing, but I just wanted to know for myself that I had read the whole Bible. And so I read the whole Bible, tried to do it quickly. And then after that, I started looking at the table of contents, and I asked myself, which book right now do I know the least? And that would always be the one that I would then print out, and I would try to read it and reread it and reread it and mark it up and notice all the repeated words and all these different sorts of things. And I remember very distinctly when I was in college, when Samantha and I were in college, when Ecclesiastes was the book that I printed out. I had read it before, and now it was time for me to try to understand it in a deeper kind of way. And Samantha and I left the dorm rooms on the college campus, and we got onto the shuttle bus to go to the cafeteria, and I had been studying Ecclesiastes. And I was very depressed and upset and frustrated about things, and Samantha asked, "What in the world is wrong with you?" And I said, "I've been reading Ecclesiastes, and it's messing with me. Because what the book of Ecclesiastes is doing is it's challenging you that if your hope and your meaning is in this life, it's very, very bleak. And what this book was doing for me, and I didn't understand a lot of the trajectory of the book at the time, but I learned from reading this that my life was too focused here and now. And that what the book of Ecclesiastes is doing is it's like taking a surgical knife and removing a tumor from your body that's part of you, so it hurts to lose it. There's pain involved in losing it, but it's ultimately good for you. And I want to go ahead and share some things that I learned from that experience when I was in college. Let's go ahead and read Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. And this is going to be the text that we base our lesson out of. And we'll look at a couple other things within the book of Ecclesiastes. But this will be our main text. "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run into the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It has been done already in the ages before. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after." In the book of Ecclesiastes, if you didn't know that it was in the Bible and you just heard somebody reading it out loud, You might conclude that this belongs in a philosophy class, that this was written by some kind of philosopher or something like that. It's very unique to the other books of the Bible. One of the things that's unique about the book of Ecclesiastes is how many questions it asks. The whole book of Ecclesiastes asks 32 questions, around there, I guess. Although that's a pretty precise number. I think it's 32. This text that we just read in verses 3 and in verse 10 asks two different questions. This is interesting because a lot of people credit people like Socrates and Plato as being some of the first prominent sort of philosophers. People talk about the Socratic method. When I was in my law classes, one of the things that we learned a lot about was the Socratic method of asking questions to get people to push their thinking in new different kinds of ways. And before Socrates and Plato, there was somebody named Solomon, who in 1 Kings chapter 3 prayed to God for wisdom, and he was given so much wisdom that people from all over the world came to listen to him. Now, it's interesting that this guy, he's asking all of these questions, but you notice in verse 1 that the writer of Ecclesiastes is called the preacher. Typically, we think of preaching as making assertions. It's a monologue. It's one person saying a bunch of stuff to exhort people and encourage them in a certain direction. But the way that this preacher encourages people is by getting them to ask questions and analyze where their heart is, how they think about the world around them, all of these different sorts of things. He's teaching in this what people today call a Socratic kind of way. And notice the question that he asks in verse 3. Ecclesiastes 1:3 again, it says, "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?" How many of us toiled this last week where we went to work? I think the traffic in Atlanta is picking up again. It seems that way. That you had to fight maybe the traffic, that there's a lot more people staying at home now. So they're doing a lot more home renovations and yard work, things like that. How many of you toiled a lot this last week? And here's what Solomon is getting you to think of. In all of the toiling that you're doing, all the work that you're doing, what's the gain? Now, the word that he uses for gain there means something like profit or what's left over or what's the permanent and lasting thing that you have after all the work that you do. By the way, this idea of gain, what's the profit of something? That's something that we want to know in so many smaller areas of life. If somebody goes and tells you to do this or to do that or go to the store and buy this or that, you want to know, well, what's the purpose of this? Why should I go do this? We ask questions like that when it comes to smaller, more mundane things. But how often do we ask this question about everything that we're doing in our life? This is what the writer of Ecclesiastes is wanting us to think about. What's the gain? What's really left over for the things that I'm pursuing in my life? And what this text is going to do is it's going to illustrate or it's going to discuss insufficient answers to that question of what's the gain for what I do. There's different worldviews that are touched on in verses 1 through 11 that show you that if you live with this worldview, you're not really going to have any gain left over. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. But notice this phrase that he uses in this text, under the sun, in verse 3. In Ecclesiastes, he's going to use this term, I believe he uses this term 25 times, under the sun. What does he mean by this phrase, under the sun? The idea of this is that life apart from God, that when you disconnect God, you don't consider God or eternity or any kind of supernatural sort of thing. When you take that out of your life, here are the conclusions that you reach. And that's one of the reasons why the book of Ecclesiastes was so depressing to me at first, is I wasn't thinking enough about eternity and those kinds of promises that God has given us. I was thinking too much about this world. By the way, when you think about that approach to trying to find meaning in life, under the sun, that there's no, we're not going to talk about eternity, we're not going to talk about God. Do you see how modern that approach is? That there's a lot of college campuses today. There's a lot of degrees that you can try to pursue. That if the other students in your cohort or the teachers know that you believe in God and that you believe that there's an afterlife and that you have your hope set on those kinds of things, that you're going to be looked at as uneducated and unsophisticated. In fact, for a long time, people have said that as technology advances and we start to learn all kinds of new, interesting things, that we're going to have less and less need for religion because all of these other things in the world that we've advanced with have been able to explain all the things that religion used to need to explain. And so when Solomon says here that there's nothing new under the sun, he's not talking about that there's not new technologies, there's cars, computers, all of these different kinds of things. He's saying that there's nothing new with regards to religious thought, that these things that he's going to deal with in verses 1 through 11, that these ideas are repackaged throughout history. And if that these are your worldviews, it's not new and it's not going to leave you any lasting gain. So what are the insufficient answers to this question of what's left over? What's the gain? The first one is the answer of humanism. You see these ideas brought up in verses 4 and verse 11. The idea of humanism says that I want to leave the world a better place. That I know that there's no such thing as God. I know that there's no such thing as eternity. But after I die, I want to know that I left my mark on the world, that I made this a better place than when I came into it. And then you ask somebody, okay, well, what does that look like in your life? Well, it means that I remember some of my favorite high school teachers and I write them a card years later telling them how much of a difference they made in my life. Or when I'm walking past cars that are parked by parking meters, that if I see one of them that's expired, that I'm going to be a good person and I'm going to add some coins to that parking meter. And I'm going to find all of these different little acts of kindness that I can do for people and things like this. Now, you see the problem with this, that if you believe that there's no such thing as God, there's no such thing as eternity, and your answer to this is going to be the gain in my life is humanism. What's the problem with this? Look at verse 4 again. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. You've got this picture that the writer of Ecclesiastes is bringing up, that generations come and go. It just kind of is like an endless wave of generations. Look down in verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. You know what the problem with this answer is? Is that you can't even remember, maybe some of you can, I know I can't. I can't remember the names of my great-great-grandparents. Were those people important in their generation? Like, were they important to their children? Were they important in their workplace? They had significance in their time, but their time has passed. And somebody might say, well, I'm really going to leave my mark by making some great innovation, or I'm going to become some kind of leader in some kind of way. But even if you become a king, the only way that we know 4,000 years later that some people were kings is by scant archaeological evidence and implicitly seeing from things that have been inscribed thousands of years ago that this person reigned at this place in some time. 40 years after I die, nobody's going to remember me. And that's just the way that the world works. That's maybe one problem with this, is that any mark that you try to make, it's not really going to be lasting. Things are going to keep going and there's going to be wickedness. In fact, look at verse 15. Look at verse 15. We didn't read this, but look at Ecclesiastes 1:15. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. This is saying that there are certain things in this world that are so crooked that you're never going to be able to really make a real impact on it. And people that live apart from God, that say that there's no such thing as God, so now I have my meaning, and I'm going to solve this problem in the world, or I'm going to solve that problem in the world, and that's going to be my meaning. There are some things that are so wicked. Injustice has existed since Adam and Eve sinned. Wickedness has existed since Adam and Eve sinned. All kinds of problems in the world are going to continually be parts of the world. And if you try to live apart from God, one of the conclusions that you have to reach here is that you're not going to really make a real dent or a real impact if you're trying to do all of this without God in the picture. Imagine for a moment that an airplane, that you were in a Boeing 747 or something, and it was going to crash. I don't know how long it takes for an airplane to crash from the height, but let's just say, for imagination's sake, it's 4 minutes. That's probably too much time. But imagine that it's 4 minutes. And it's starting to go down. And while it's going down, somebody exits the bathroom of the plane and they go, "The light's not working in the bathroom. Somebody's got to fix this." Why does it matter? Because the whole plane's going down anyway. If your worldview says that the only thing in life is what's here and now, there's no God, there's no eternity, nothing like that, and you're going to try to make a difference in this world, you're just fixing the light on a plane that's going to crash anyways. What's the ultimate purpose? Here's the second worldview that this text touches on, and that's the answer of hedonism. Hedonism is the worldview that says that pleasure is my highest goal. That what I'm trying to seek after in my life, that there's no God, there's no eternity, everything's under the sun. The thing that I'm living for is for my pleasures. Now we'll see how the text deals with that in just a moment. But how does this worldview look today? If somebody says, "All right, I'm just going to live for the here and now," well, sometimes it means that you cast off all moral restraint and you do whatever you want to do. But there's a more sophisticated version of hedonism that says, "Well, I don't want to live like an animal, but what the things that give me pleasure are family. And it's beautiful sunsets, and it's traveling all over the world and seeing all the beautiful parts of the world and things like that. That's what gives me pleasure." Whichever form somebody wants to take, if you're trying to find fulfillment in that apart from God, what are the problems with this? Look at verse 1 again in this text. In Ecclesiastes 1:1, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Do you see Solomon's pedigree here? There's debates about whether or not it was really Solomon. I'm just going to assume that it was Solomon that wrote this. That this writer was a king. That he had so many things at his disposal that he could have lived however he wanted to live as a king. Go down to verse 8. In verse 8, he says, "All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." He's saying here, and he's going to talk more about this in chapter 2. We'll see this in just a moment, that the eye is not satisfied with seeing. The ear is not satisfied with hearing. That he's tried all of these different kinds of things to please his senses. And what he's learned is that he's never really satisfied under the sun in that way. In fact, I've been wanting to preach a sermon on this. I don't know when I'm ever going to get around to it. But there's 6 things in Ecclesiastes that Solomon tries to find fulfillment in that you can make start with a W. So the first one is wisdom, and at the end of chapter 1. That the pleasure that I'm going to have is going to be this more sophisticated pleasure of intellectual pursuits. And that's what gives me satisfaction. Or look at chapter 2, verse 1. "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity," wantonness, just being able to do whatever you feel like doing. Chapter 2, verse 3 talks about wine, how he was going to try to get involved with alcohol and see if that did it. Chapter 2, verses 4 through 6 talk about work. Chapter 2, verse 8 talks about women. He deals with all of these different sorts of things, and the conclusion that he reaches in chapter 1, verse 8, is that the eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear is not satisfied with hearing. He hired musicians, they didn't have iPods back then, and earbuds and everything, so if you were really rich, what you did was you hired musicians that just kind of sang songs and played their instruments whenever you wanted them to do that. Do you suppose Solomon had everything at his disposal to be able to find out if hedonism was the right way to live? And do you suppose that there's perhaps a lot of ways in which we might have similar kinds of things at our disposal to find out the same thing? If what you're trying to seek in this life is just simply pleasure, have you realized at this point that the eye is never satisfied with seeing, the ear is never satisfied with hearing? You're always going to need to see more and more and more and hear more and do more, and you're never really going to be satisfied. There's no gain. Notice, before we move on, if you could go to your neighbors and knock on their door and be socially distant and start to poll all of them and ask them, if you could have blank in your life to make you satisfied, what would it be? What do you think people would say? If I had a spouse, if I had more money, if I had more satisfaction in my workplace, all these different kinds of things. And here's what Solomon is saying. No, it's not going to do it. Notice the third worldview is nihilism. And if you don't know what nihilism is, it's the same thing as existentialism. And if you don't know what that is, I'm going to attempt to try to explain it. The idea of nihilism, if I'm even pronouncing that the right way, is that you accept that life is meaningless. And so I'm going to try to carve out my own meaning, but I know still that even at the end of the day, that there's still ultimately no meaning in life. Verses 5 through 7 kind of depict that worldview where he talks about the sun rising, the sun setting, the sun rising, the sun sitting. The wind is going all over the place. The streams of water fill these bodies of water, but then they're never full. And you got to get this picture of nothing is really ever going anywhere. That there's really no ultimate purpose for anything. I remember when I was in high school, I had a friend who called himself a nihilist. And one of the interesting things is that this guy who didn't believe in God, he didn't believe in eternity, he didn't believe in any of that kind of thing, that he still believed that there was some overall sense of purpose, that we need to be concerned with greater things in the world and making the world a better place. But if you pressed him on it, he'd say, well, that's what I personally reached. But then he would try to help other people get on the same bandwagon. But you'd ask him, well, what's the ultimate gain of some of these kinds of things? And you'd say, well, there's no ultimate gain. It's just kind of what I'm trying to do right now. Go look at Ecclesiastes 1:17. Skip down to verse 17. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but striving after wind. When he says here that I applied my heart to try to know wisdom, that I'm trying to see what is wise according to the world. But then he also says, and to know madness and folly. Does that worldview of nihilism sound like madness and folly? Friedrich Nietzsche, who is a very famous nihilist, is famously quoted as saying, every belief, every considering of something true is necessarily false because there is simply no true world. And then your question is, well, is that true? Because it seems like you're trying to make some kind of assertion, but you're saying that nothing is really true. There's really no meaning and purpose in life. And you can see that as Solomon is working through these different depictions of different worldviews, that he's going to use the word vanity of vanities. Vanity of vanities. What does the word vanity mean? It's the idea of something fleeting. It's something that's meaningless. It's like a vapor. Look at verse 14. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, what we were just talking about. And then he adds this thought to it, and a striving after the wind. When I was in Minnesota, and it would be winter for 20 months out of the year, if you'd breathe in the morning or any time of the day, really, you'd see the whatever it's called leaving you, the breath or whatever, you can see it sort of. But if you tried to grab it, it's going to go away. I've never seen anybody that took a bunch of mason jars and collected wind and closed the cap and then like had a bunch of mason jars in their house and said, hey, do you want to come check out my wind collection? Nobody does that because you can't collect it. You can't catch it. Solomon is saying here that life under the sun, you can come up with all of these different philosophies, all of these things that get repackaged in every generation. And the only thing that you have is trying to grasp after the wind. There's nothing. So what is the only sufficient answer? Look at Ecclesiastes. Go over to Ecclesiastes chapter 12. And you can see as he reasons through with some of these kinds of things, you can feel the surgical knife cutting away some of the cancerous thoughts that we might have at times. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and look at verses 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. What are the instructions that the writer of Ecclesiastes gives at the end of this? The first thing is to fear God. All right, you have all these interesting philosophies that sound sophisticated and all this kind of thing. And then, do you ever wonder why Christianity seems like it's so unsophisticated and uneducated? You got all these interesting words and all these kinds of things. And then you say, well, you have to fear God. You have to have a high respect for him. You have to tremble before him, knowing that if you're not living the right way before him, that he could send you into eternal judgment. But fearing him also includes this idea of a great reverence. That when I live with that perspective, I actually have the ability to enjoy the things of life better than the hedonist does. You know why? Let's say that I'm really into gardening. That gardening is my thing that I really love. We tried making a garden this year and the chickens destroyed all of it. I think we have a couple things left over, but not much. There's not much gain to it all. But if I'm into gardening, or I'm into the sunset, or I'm into camping and hiking and everything like that, that I can connect all these things that I enjoy with the God who created it. If you're living under the sun, all you have is the garden. All you have is the sunset. You don't have the God that made all of that. Living with the perspective of fearing God and connecting him to everything that you do. But notice also, it's fearing God and keeping his commandments. If he's the creator, if he's the one that made us, then he would know what's best for us. If I tried taking my cell phone, or if I tried taking this clicker, and I tried using it as a hammer, and then it shattered and it broke, and I threw the thing away in anger, and I said, "This is a terrible hammer." Well, that's not what it was made for. What if Thomas the Tank Engine, that's a clear lead into Thomas the Tank or Train Engine or whatever it is, what if he decided that one day, I don't want to be restricted to these tracks anymore. I want freedom. And then Thomas, the train engine, gets off the tracks and he just falls over. The only way that you find your greatest freedom and your greatest potential is to live within the realm and the rules and the commandments of the God who created you and knows what's best for you. And as soon as you try to cast those aside, you're no longer living within the bounds for which you were created. Fear God. Keep his commandments. And notice that he also talks about how this God is going to one day judge everything. By the way, if you're keeping God's commandments, are you going to find yourself doing some of the same things that these other people in the world, in these different worldviews are going to do? This idea that of humanism, for example, that I want to make the world a better place. Well, somebody who's keeping God's commandments, will they find themselves sometimes doing some of the same things as those people with that worldview? Sometimes they will. The difference is, you're doing it with respect to God. And you're doing it with respect to what we're going to have in eternity. And you're doing it with respect to Final Judgment Day. Do you know why Final Judgment is good news for us? Because on Final Judgment Day, every word that we uttered is going to be taken into account. That the things that we did in our life, all of these things are going to be taken into account, which suddenly means that everything has meaning and purpose. Because if God is going to assess us on these things, and if God is going to judge us based on the faith and the way that we live, that means that everything I do suddenly has meaning and purpose, because there's a God that sees and there's a God that's going to judge me one day. Throughout the book, talks about life under the sun. Life under the sun. That you disconnect God, that there's nothing new. But the New Testament teaches that there is something that is new. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. You ever noticed how in the world, sin just gets repackaged from generation to generation, and Satan kind of makes it look the same in a lot of different ways. And the people in the world that live under the sun, apart from God, there's this kind of a continuity, that there's this addiction to something in the world that's not really satisfying you, that it kind of looks the same in a lot of different places. Until one day they finally meet somebody that's new. Somebody that I can't explain. Somebody that lives with a different kind of purpose. What's different about you? And the answer is that the Son of God came under the sun and he showed us a new path. All of us in this room right now, we're all learning something about God. You can either learn something about God by proactively seeking Him and understanding who He is according to the Scriptures, asking the question, what is this passage teaching me about God? Seeing what the Bible says about God. That's one way that you can learn about God. You can also learn about God by His absence. And what I mean by that is by you disconnecting from Him. And you learning that apart from God, there's no real meaning in life. That all you find is addiction to all kinds of worldly things that you're going to need more and more and more of. This morning, are you learning about God in your life based on what you're proactively seeking towards Him? Or have you been learning more about God based on how you've been disconnecting from Him and the voids that that's been leaving in your life? If you've been learning about God based on what you're proactively seeking, keep doing that. But if you've been learning about Him because you haven't been seeking Him like you ought to, this is an opportunity for you to learn to fear God, keep His commandments, and understand that everything you do matters because one day there is going to be a final judgment. We're about to sing the song, Take My Life and Let It Be. Are we letting God take our life? Are we letting Him be the ruler of our life? Are we trusting that He, as the Creator, knows what's best for us? This is an opportunity to get our life right with God. If there's anybody that has any needs, don't leave here without talking to somebody or coming forward while we stand and while we sing.